The House Committee on Greater Minnesota Economic and Workforce Development Policy will come to order. We do not have a quorum yet, so we will hold off with the minutes and we will get rolling. Today we're privileged to have former House member Brad Finstead, who serves as the Executive Director of the Center for Rural Policy and Development. Before I go on, I failed to do something here. Our regular CLA is absent today, and we have Shirley Kotterick with us. She is CLA for Ways and Means. I'd like to welcome her to the committee. We're off again. Brad is going to provide us with an overview of state of rural Minnesota. Welcome, Mr. Finstead. Please state your name and title for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. My name is Brad Finstead, and I am the president of the Center for Rural Policy and Development. We're a statewide rural policy organization, formerly housed out of St. Peter, and now we're more virtual because of the vast amount of miles and hilltops far and few between in rural Minnesota. We like to say our office is out of our vehicles now. We're traveling everywhere. So thank you for having me here. And as I talked to the committee administrator, Laura, and Representative Gunther, we talked about maybe laying or presenting a 30,000-foot view of some demographic trends that are going on in rural Minnesota, and I will try to drill down a little bit into the demographic data and what it means in regards to potential policy issues. Hopefully it'll, as you build your committee work this session, it will create, again, a baseline of some understanding of some rural Minnesota trends. Just a quick introduction of the center. We are a unique organization. We are a independent nonprofit 501c3 that was formed via partnership with the state of Minnesota and some of the leading foundations in the state, Bremer, Blandin, McKnight Foundation, came together in about 1997 with a group of rural legislators to really try to put the lens on rural Minnesota when it comes to some of the trends and then furthermore policy and what it means to rural Minnesota. So we were originally based out of Mankato State and then branched off into St. Peter, and now again we're a virtual office. Our board is primarily appointed by the governor.
Yes, sir.
And we also have an appointment from the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader. So we have a diverse board of leaders that bring a lot of different perspectives to our organization.
Mr. Finstead, I apologize if I'm going to stop just for a minute. We do have a quorum now, and so we can approve the minutes. I was wondering if any, okay. Representative Ryan Johnson has moved to approve the minutes. All in favor?
Aye.
Minutes are approved. Continue, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we'll get into this presentation. So one of the pieces in the enabling legislation for the center was to provide a yearly report to the legislature and the governor's office on the state of rural Minnesota. So this is a project that we put out each year, and so we're happy to present it today. So the first slide takes a look at the population changes that have happened in Minnesota, and I want to point out that as we go through this, you'll see that the metro area is included in all of our data. And you know, for us as a rural organization, it's super important for us to take a look at where we have commonalities with our metro brothers and sisters and where there are some differences, and it helps us establish an understanding for potential policy collaboration and also helps us understand the unique needs of different regions. So you'll notice that as we go through here, the metro area is included in all of this data. So if you look at the population change from 1990 to 2013, one of the things that we like to highlight is, you know, you see that kind of that western edge of Minnesota and the southern tier, and you see that L forming where you're seeing some population loss. And this is more of a reference point as we build upon this throughout this presentation, but just for your reference, that is the data from 1990 to 2013. looking a little bit deeper into history back to 1960, you'll see where that the population loss has, again, I like to say kind of more in the deep rural part of the state. And you start seeing that population gain that's almost a corridor from that St. Cloud area all the way down to Rochester. And then you'll see the surrounding counties of that corridor that's expressed somewhat of a population gain over those years. So, you know, when we talk about metro and rural, I don't think it's fair, you know, it's much deeper than a two-part kind of way to look at Minnesota. I mean, we have deeper rural pockets that have unique needs, and this data will show, highlight some of those needs. Projected population change from 2010 to 2045. You'll see here, again, where you start to see a little bit of a slowing population gain in that urban core. Second, third tier suburbs still show growth, and then we have those pockets in rural Minnesota where we're seeing still projected declines. But I would say probably not as severe as history has presented. Median age, in 2013, you'll see here that there is some note for, I don't know if concern's the right word, but you know, I really want people to be aware of, you look at, again, some of those deeper rural pockets in Minnesota, in rural Minnesota here, where you're starting to see the average age, the median age creep up, 46 and above, and you know, from a policy perspective, you all will be addressing issues in long-term care, transportation, property taxes. You know, if you start looking at a deeper rural population that has a fixed income based on retirement, Social Security, maybe aging services needs, you know, just how we fund basic infrastructure in some of these communities will be issues that we need to keep in the forefront of our thoughts. Projected population age 19 and under to show where maybe the youth movement will be. Again, some highlights here is there is some pockets, again, in rural Minnesota that we're seeing a rebound, so to speak, of some younger population. Projected population at age 65 plus. You'll see here there's 12 counties in rural Minnesota that will have a population, a third of their population or more, over the age of 65. And again, so the ripple effect, so to speak, from a policy perspective is, you know, looking into these pockets, into these communities, and basic infrastructure, whether it be everything from wastewater to property tax, you know, the way we fund government, to long-term care needs. But you'll definitely see here the pockets and the trends that develop, and with that, you know, all the policy issues that you all will have to wrestle with. And I like to point out, you know, this is projected to 2045. So, as a former member, I know we get into two-year cycles, but this definitely defies any two-year term that any of you or past members like me will serve. So this is, you know, keeping the eye on quite a bit into the future.
Can I interrupt you just for a second? Would you be willing to take questions now? Or? Okay.
As long as they're easy.
Representative Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a real quick question, Mr. Finstead. Just on the median age, what's the national average? What's the national median age?
Mr. Chair and members, I don't have the exact number with me, but we can follow that up.
Small question. Yep. I apologize. Thank you.
Yep. Okay. And then Representative Barrett, you had a question?
Yep. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just a quick question about the page we're on here, I guess, projected population 65 and older. So I'm looking at it. I don't really see a rural-urban disparity, I guess, for lack of a better word. I see the Iron Range being very old or projected to be fairly old. But then, you know, you look at Beltrami County, which is says less than 24.9. That's right next to Lake of the Woods, which is projected to have a lot of people. Why would there be such a huge difference? I don't know. Is there a college around there? I guess I don't know the area too well. But I guess just the bigger issue of rural versus urban and whether there is a big difference in projected in 30 years regarding age.
Mr. Finstead?
Yeah, so I don't know. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I can specifically answer it. I, you know, with projections, obviously we take a look at today's population and ages, and we can project out where it is. So the intricacies of colleges and whatnot, I don't have the answer to that. But I do have the answer to Representative Miller's question. U.S. Is 37.6.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Norton.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Finstead, you've got lots of great data here, and I'm sneaking ahead trying to look to see if you've got solutions, because as I'm looking at the information and rural Minnesota growing older, what suggestions, and I'm hoping they'll be there, and I just haven't found them yet, I shouldn't be cheating, but to find out what suggestions you have for changing the economy to accommodate areas that are growing older and don't have the young people that are staying to replace it, because it, you know, the things that we might do in an area that's heavily populated or densely populated with younger people is going to be very different than an area that doesn't have any young people living in it. So I'm just, you know, maybe you have a quick answer to give us some sneak peek about suggestions, or maybe you're just going to provide data and we have to come up with those solutions ourselves. But
Mr. Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Norton. I got out of the solution business in 08. So, no. But I... And I say that tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, as a research organization that tries to, you know, we try our hardest, we're nonpartisan, we're unbiased, we really like to throw research and good data out there, hopefully, you know, the outcome is to help you all make better informed decisions. So, obviously, we have partners that we work with as we develop this research that do have, you know, ideas to address some of those things, and, you know, be more than happy to connect that. But, I retired from that in 08.
Representative Morton, you have a follow-up?
Not really.
Okay. Continue, Mr. Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we'll move on to some of the trends and digging in a little bit deeper, and hopefully that would open some conversation or open some policy ideas in the long run. But nine counties that have shown growth between 90 and 2012 was due to the increase in minority population. And so, you know, we look at Nobles County and look at the decrease in the white population, increase in minority population to show a net gain. Why does that matter? And you'll see in future slides how that plays out into the school district information. The trickle down of that is workforce issues. If you take a look at one of the major employers in that county, an ag-based employer, if the trend of decreasing of population rules the day, companies like that packing plant in Worthington would have to make very tough decisions on where they locate or if they stay. So this is an important slide to really kind of get your head around what the future of Minnesota looks like, where these pockets of new Minnesotans are. And with that, it also shows that there's different things from a statewide perspective that we really can work together on. It's not an us versus them approach, but you know, you look at Hennepin County and some of the challenges or some of the opportunities that this slide creates, it's played out in other counties, other rural counties. So the opportunity there exists then for communities to reach out to others that share this. That would be our hope.
Okay, Representative Mahoney, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Finstead, why not, you know, to go back to Representative Norton's kind of question request, if you've had researchers looking and correlating all this data, you know, that's what they get paid for. They get paid to kind of think futuristic. Why don't you share that with the committee if you could? Even if it's just through the chair or individual committees on a listserv or what, however you want to do it, but you know, those we're part time. We don't think about this all the time, and you just have spent a lot of money with people that think about it all the time. So maybe it'd be good for us. Please,
Mr. Finstead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mahoney. I appreciate that. I would be more than happy to. So we work. We're a small shop. I mean, there's two employees at the organization, so we are always working with partners. So I would be more than happy to connect some of our partners and some of the ideas that those folks have came up with as we worked on this to the committee. You know, historically and as nature of the research organization that we are, I mean, there's a fine line of providing that unbiased, unspun data versus advocacy entering into the political world. So we're very cautious of that. But I appreciate your question, and we will do what we can to tie some of those folks and potential solutions to you.
Representative Mahoney, a follow-up question? Okay, thank you.
So the next slide talks about the distribution of people of color. And you'll look here that the 6.3% of the population in 1990, for the state's population of color has grown from 6.3% to a statewide percentage of 14.5%. And what's unique about this is you'll see the distribution is pretty evenly spread out throughout the state. It's not centralized to one community or the metro area or a regional center in rural Minnesota, but it's somewhat evenly distributed. And then here you'll see the change in distribution of people of color since 1990. And you'll notice here that the larger percentages of change or the increase has happened more prominently in rural Minnesota than the inner metro communities. So now we get into the income side.
Representative Norton.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm curious as to, some of these are just really fascinating, and I'm wondering, have you identified a reason for the, you know, there's an area that's dropped significantly? Is it a business that's closed up? What's causing a minority population to leave a whole county in large numbers? And I wonder if you've identified a couple of those.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Norton. That is you're highlighting an issue in rural Minnesota, and that is we are so spread out and we have so many unique stories that there's probably about 1,000 different answers to that question. Very community specific, very industry related in some cases. There's tons of different stories. So, you know, we could, and I could follow up maybe with some specifics in regards to some certain areas to give you a flavor of why, but if anybody, you know, I would assume those of you that maybe see your districts on this maybe have some answers too from what you see just, you know, walking down Main Street.
And Mr. Chair, could I follow up?
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a slide page. Change in the distribution of people of color 1990 to 2012. Okay, the one you have up here now. There is a one lone light colored that's 0 to minus 31%. And that one in particular, if there's a story to that, I'd be interested in hearing. You don't have to tell me now because it may require some work. But I'm just interested in if an industry or a business has closed up, if there's a story behind that one in particular. Thanks.
Mr. Finstead, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, Representative Norton, we will follow up with that.
Okay.
Thank you. So the median household income. And this is where you start to see a little bit more of a disparity, more of a trend. Again, it highlights earlier, you know, we talked about some of that, the age demographic issues earlier on in this presentation where I had mentioned somewhat of a corridor developing between that St. Cloud all the way to Rochester area. This reflects that from the income side. So whether it's age-related, opportunity-related, industry-related, you know, there's, again, another 100 different scenarios that could play out. But you'll see here that we have that upper north-central part of the state that there is a region there where it's you know, noticeably lower than surrounding communities and the state on the whole. So I should probably interject here. So this wasn't this presentation and this format, just as a reference, we brought in a panel of legislators about 4 years ago. So at the time it would have been Representative Morrow, Representative Cornish, Gunther, Senator Sharon, Rosen, Representative Kathy Breinert. And we went over about 100 of these slides. And they kind of helped us narrow it down to, you know, here's 20, 25 slides that help, that as, you know, their advice was as legislators would help us make informed decisions. So that, I should probably state it at the front end, that this wasn't just me thinking of what would be fun to show you. This was past members kind of giving us their advice. So we transition a little bit to give you a flavor of some of the economics to industries. And you look at the farming sector or agriculture sector, You'll definitely see here what a stronghold or strength it is in Minnesota, and not just in rural Minnesota. You see that the shades of green that, you know, extend into the metro area. Probably pretty obvious to a lot of you, but it's nice to see it, nice to see county by county and where they're all pitted against one another in regards to the state averages. But definitely the stronghold over the last 6 years in agriculture has been very prominent in the southern half of the state, more so the southern quarter, you know, where you're seeing steel average land prices $8,000 to $10,000 an acre. You know, we just came off a very strong commodity market, corn market, and you know, we're seeing a slight rebound, or we have seen a slight rebound in receipts livestock. So you'll see that, you know, definitely here on this map that reflects the strength in the last 3 years of agriculture. So then with that, we wanted...
Representative Keeley, a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we're looking at these farming numbers, Mr. Finn said, and we look at employed directly in farming, we are talking about actually working farms, right? Not all the agricultural jobs that surround farming. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Mr. Finstead?
Yep, Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
And there is, so this is a tough tough piece of data to really evaluate or slice with the knife, because there's some fine lines the way the census data captures some of that. You know, for instance, they use, in some cases, they cite farmers as those that make more than $1,500 a year in gross receipts, which, you know, I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but it can skew the numbers a little bit if you have quite a variety of range. And then also, you know, how agribusiness is defined. But for this, yeah, it's people directly employed in farming.
Directly. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Mahoney?
Yes. My question is more to, did you get the numbers just from the census tract? Did you go to DEED and their Department of Labor Statistics or unemployment, or... Where did those particular numbers come up on farm income at 60,000 and above, or 35 to 59,000?
So I believe we have it cited on there. The Department of Commerce Bureau and Economic Analysis, and then we most of the work that we put out in this, we have folks at either DEED or other state agencies that have that this is interested that they would have an interest in. We have them take a look at it. But for this one, you know, what it says on the slide, the U.S. Department of Commerce Bureau of Economic Analysis. And I think without highlighting it, but you're highlighting that, you know, the way different organizations or agencies look at some of these things, sometimes we have some data that doesn't quite speak. It's not quite apples to apples sometimes, so it is important to know where the data came from.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney?
And the reason I ask is I've seen data that, I mean, there's a substantial number of farm workers that it would be interesting to see how that breaks down, because you have a lot of farm workers that aren't making the 60,000. You have a lot of farm workers apparently that are making the 60,000. I'm kind of wondering how that splits out. And I suppose I can get that out of DEED probably just as readily as elsewhere. So, but unless you have any other idea on how to split that out, that, because that would be interesting.
And Mr. Chair, I'll go back to the drawing board and get that for you. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can get that data pretty quickly, mm-hmm. and we'll email it to you.
And Mr. Chair, and kind of the reason I ask is because $35,000 for a family of four is just barely over the poverty levels, but $35,000 for a single adult is, you know, it may not be what I want to live on, but it's, you know, you're not starving. So I guess I'm kind of trying to figure that particular piece out.
And we, Mr. Chair, we can get that data to you to break it down a little bit further to the committee.
And one more question.
Okay. Representative Mahoney.
And I'm going to go to that different slide, and it's unfortunately going back to the change in distribution of people of color. And maybe you were trying to answer this with Representative Norton, but it looks like, and frankly, I'm not sure the color printing didn't fuzz some of this. So that's not. The 0 to 70% change in populations of color looks like it's a huge swath across the north, central, northwestern part of the state, and then across a couple places in the south. But I think your answer was there's 1,000 different reasons. If you could dig deeper a little bit into that and get back to the committee, or get back to me at least, I would appreciate it, because that seems like a that's almost like an abandonment of that particular section of the state by people of color when you have 70% reduction in population or change. Depends on, I guess, whether it's a change upwards or downwards.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this slide, workforce farming in 2011, when will we see numbers that are a little bit tighter to the current year? Because as you know, agriculture has kind of had a shift this year and probably into the next couple of years.
Yeah. So thank you, Mr. Chair. We're in the process right now of updating those numbers.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Sundin.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment to help Representative Mahoney out with that. Some of those northern counties are so sparsely populated, you could have one sled dog accident and skew the numbers of who lives in that county. So keep that in mind as we look at these numbers.
Mr. Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we move on to the average earnings in the retail sector, and this is and we have, you know, multiple sectors broke down again for time and for not to to bore you for hours on end. We just picked a select few slides. We have quite a bit more information that if you would need, we would have available for you. But we took a look at the retail sector here just to highlight the disparities isn't the right word, but to kind of see the regionality of the differences in regards to the earnings in that sector. And then on top of that, we put the workforce that are involved in the retail sector. So this is the, and Representative Miller, before you have to ask, this is 11. We're updating this one, too.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things to understand that I know that you're dealing with is when you say 30,000 foot level, we start looking at charts and we start splitting this up. And I know that, because I always look at my counties whenever I'm doing this, and when I see numbers, I go, well, what does that mean? Well, I look at ag just over to retail. Well, in my county of Renville County, there's very little retail in context of what you're probably, so when you talk about one sled dog accident, well, out by us, you have one business that changes in Renville County in retail. It can have I think that's one of the things that I'd like to encourage us all to remember is that these are a little bit trends. These are a little bit, take a look at them, but sometimes there's other factors that can make these numbers look the way they are. And that's it. Thank you.
Mr. Vinson.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So now we slide into the slide here, the public assistance payments per capita, and you'll see on the right here what we've included just for this report. And again, this is a slide that can, you know, the more we add, it can change the view a little bit. But for this purpose, we included the programs on the right, and you'll see here again that northern half of the state stands out, and then also the Hennepin, Ramsey County. And what I would point out there is, again, you know, opportunities for rural and metro Minnesota to work together as one. You know, there's issues here that clearly go beyond any border, any county, any region. And, you know, so the more we can focus on things that bring the state together as one, I think the better when it comes to data.
Representative Norton?
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, if you could, you know, this may not be your area of expertise, Mr. Finstead, but since it's a per capita basis, why the ring suburb difference? It's the first time we've seen the ring suburbs show up like this in any of the slides, so I just wondered if it's just those are more affluent and stable communities, and so public assistance isn't going into them. But if it's per capita, that shouldn't be the case, I don't think. So I'm just wondering if you had an explanation, and I'm just missing it today.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I don't have a well thought out, well prepared explanation, so I think I can come back to you with that. I would say if you would look at probably some of the, you know, if you would layer a lot of the data together, I think the answer would maybe become a little more apparent, and I can take a deeper look.
Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norton, I can take a stab at it. It's probably the sled dog analogy we talked about earlier. I think if you look at those counties that are white, they're fairly heavily populated and probably have a higher or a lower unemployment rate than other areas of the state. So you have fewer people on assistance as a percentage of the total population, making the per capita really low, is my best guess.
Mr. Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving on, we have a couple slides here, school district related, and we're almost done. So students of color, this is broke down now to school districts versus counties, so you'll see the map looks a little different here, but you know, the highlight here is just to look at how, you know, how this isn't confined to a region or a small sliver of the state. This is Minnesota. I mean, this map is Minnesota, and it's just, I think, a good reference to for all of us to have and see. Language spoken at home. And you know, from a rural perspective, an education perspective, I mean, I think this is good data to know where your school districts are, the different challenges or opportunities that this creates. But you'll see there is a good handful plus of rural school districts that have multiple languages spoken at home from their school families. You know, you'll see that the darkest green, 47 to 114 as a high of languages spoken at home. You know, I mean, think about, and for those of you that serve on the education committee, I mean, that's good information to know, and specifically to know, you know, by school district where it is and how it breaks out. Again, not centralized to one location or another, you know, somewhat evenly spread throughout the state. Free lunch eligibility. You'll see here, it's almost like the converse looking map of the income, that corridor from St. Cloud to Rochester, how it almost indirectly or directly relates to this in regards to the percentage of students that are eligible for free and reduced lunch. You'll see that quite a bit of rural Minnesota is looking at that 47%+ of their students that are eligible for free and reduced lunch. You know, one of the follow-up research pieces that we did at the center was we asked the simple question of who feeds these children during the summer. You know, obviously in a metro area, locations and opportunities so that summer lunch program is more easily accessible. And from a rural perspective, some of these rural school districts where, you know, the hub may be 15, 20 miles away from where some of those students live during the summer. So it's an interesting, you know, follow-up to this slide to think about in a little different way, but we were able to put some good information together, and we've seen some rural communities really get together and try to address that issue of creating some good, strong summer school lunch programs. So with that,
Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So I'm looking at the public assistance payments and what the landscape looks like compared to the free lunch eligibility, and I'm looking at like St. Louis County, which is just like totally full of public assistance, but the free and reduced lunches is not as, you know, populated. So I was wondering, is that because it's an older population or not as many school young folks, or?
Mr. Chair, I guess I don't have a direct answer. I mean, you look at the school district breakout in that county, you know, so it's a little, you know, we're talking countywide versus school district wide. You'll see that Duluth area is carved out a little bit of less eligible. The deeper rural that county gets, the more reliant or the more eligible It could be a population issue, just, you know, maybe the sled dog. That'll be a new term now for us, the sled dog analogy or the sled musher analogy. I like it.
All right.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Finstead, just taking a look at, I hate to go back to several slides, but the projected population age 19 and under, just for the sake of this committee, I'm wondering if it wouldn't be beneficial to, say, you know, get some of those numbers for the population, say, between 25 and, well, the working age, I suppose, 65, you know, just for the sake of this committee, the Workforce Development Committee, taking a look, because as I look at this 19 and under, I'm thinking, okay, those, you know, folks are in school. I guess what I'm trying to get at is taking a look at the people who may be going to college right now, who may be getting those degrees. So I'm just kind of thinking, if you take a look at 25 to 65, that real prime working age, that may give us a good indication of where those folks are in the state. So thank you.
Any other questions? Then I want to thank you, Mr. Finstead. This was extremely informative. It's good information.
Mr. Chair, one last piece. I believe this was in your handouts. So this is just a quick summary of some of the latest research that we've done. We've transitioned from hard copy to everything that we do is on our website, ruralmn.org. So if any of this intrigues you, you can hop on there and take a look at that. A lot more infographics, a lot more maps. And to Representative Lean's question, if you have specific data requests like that, please use us. Please drop us an email, and we'll be more than happy to put those slides together for you. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, excuse me. Representative Norton has a question.
Well, I was just going to echo my thanks for your presentation, and I think you've been on the radio, NPR, recently talking about the great work that's been done in the last 2 years in greater Minnesota, and I'm looking forward to see the effects, because this goes back 2011 and 12, the influx workforce development, economic development, broadband, quarters of commerce. There's been a lot of great work that's already been done, and I'm hoping that in the next year or two we'll see some positive trends, and this committee can continue to work to see if we can't focus on these areas. But thank you so much for your presentation.
Okay, next I'd like to invite Commissioner Ken Peterson of the Department of Labor and Industry. He's going to provide us provide the committee with an overview. Welcome, Commissioner Peterson. If you would please state your name and title for the record.
My name is Ken Peterson. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry in Minnesota. And, Mr. Chairman and members, it's a pleasure to be here. What I'd like to do is just, with me today is also Deputy Commissioner Jessica Luman and our Government Affairs Director, John McCallister, both here with us. And so if I run into questions I can't understand, right, I'm going to ask for, I'll be calling on them. The we passed out a little brochure, whatever the word is. Obviously, we get going from that. And as you can see, on the first page, actually, the second page, our mission is to ensure that Minnesota's work and living environments are equitable, healthy, and safe. We regulate a lot of workplaces in terms of OSHA, workers' compensation, and also license a number of professional trades that I'll be going through in detail. We operating areas, workers' compensation, OSHA compliance and OSHA consultation, labor standards, apprenticeship, construction codes and licensing, and general support. We have offices, we have about 450 employees, and then about 70 or 75 contract employees, which I'll go into detail a little bit on that. We have offices in St. Paul, Rochester, Mankato, St. Cloud, Duluth, and Bemidji. But most of our staff are located here, probably about 350 located in St. Paul, the rest located throughout the rest of the state. Next page, just an organizational chart. You can see that as with most agencies, the deputy commissioner is in charge of the daily operations of the agency. People report to her and all their functions. And we don't need to spend a lot of time on that, but just want to point that out. And we also deal with Minnesota on a daily basis. Our revenues. The Department of Labor and Industry is interesting in that we have very few very little dollars come in general fund, about 1% or a little more, maybe roughly around 1% of our funds come from the general fund. The largest source of funds is 68% comes from the workers' compensation fund. That's assessment on premiums paid by businesses or other agencies on workers' comp. The next largest section is the Construction Codes and Licensing Division. It's 23%, about $55 million per biennium. That comes from licensing fees, permitting fees, that sort of thing. Then we have the federal funds, about 4%. That's mostly for due to OSHA, but also a few, like $100,000 or $200,000 comes from a BLS survey we do every year for the U.S. Department of Labor. Then the Contract Recovery Fund, which is a complete pass-through, which I'll describe later on, is about $6.5 million a year. Workforce Development Fund funds our apprenticeship program. It's less than 1%. And then the General Fund is less than 1%, and that funds our Labor Standards Office. And I'll go in detail and describe what they do. The next page is just our expenditures, of what we how we do things. You'll see the biggest single chunk is workers' compensation benefits paid by the department, which is $116 million per biennium. Those are basically three benefits. Three benefits, supplementary. Two of the benefits were wiped out or eliminated by the legislature back in the mid-90s. One's called supplementary benefits, the other's called second injury benefits. A third are from uninsured employers or bankrupt employers, employees hurt by somebody doesn't have insurance or is bankrupt, and that's still going on. The supplementary benefits of second injury funds will eventually wear out probably sometime in 2030 or 2040 because people just die off and receive those benefits today.
We have some questions, and sure. I'm just going to ask the members if you could wait till the end, that'd be great. But if you need, if you want to ask right away, just wave your hand, and we'll get you anyway. So. Okay, go ahead.
It doesn't make any difference to me. It's however you want to do, Mr. Chairman. I can take them right now, or if you want to.
Well, I don't think we've got a whole lot of time, and I don't know how long your presentation is going to be. So.
Okay, fine. You can see where the workers' compensation benefits are 47%. Then the next thing is construction codes and licensing. Most of that will go into salaries. OSHA is 10%. The with the OSHA, we have, I'll describe with several different programs that are also pass-throughs, which I'll describe. And then workers' comp administration costs 9%, general support in our department is 8%, and apprenticeship labor standards 2%. But the next chart is the one that sort of describes in detail what we do in more detail. That here we're dividing it into operations and external funding. 40% of our funds go for operations, 60% goes to external purposes, goes outside of the department. The I think you can see it, the DLI agency total is for salaries, $36 million per, because this is 1 year, and operations, other operations, $13 million, a total of 50. But then in the external, every year we spend $76 million. And if you go down to the, you know, where it says workers' compensation, special compensation fund, those are the benefit claims I talked about for injured workers that we're just basically sending out checks to insurance companies or directly to reimburse insurance companies or directly to injured workers. Then on the workers' compensation special fund, we also pay for the operations, the workers' compensation court of appeals, which is the sort of the mid-level court for workers' compensation. Then the Office of Administrative Hearings has got about 20 people, 20 judges who do work comp work, and that pays for their operations. Then we spend $650,000 every year that goes to the Department of Commerce for fraud investigations. For OSHA workplace safety consultation, we have two programs that are pretty interesting. One is called Safety Grants. This was funded out of the fines that come from workers' compensation, mostly against insurance companies, for late payments, that sort of thing, and for fines from our CCLD division. Then that money is turned over. Every year we give out safety grants for up to $10,000 a grant to businesses, communities, nursing homes, hospitals, to help them purchase something to help their safety, for like a nursing home, some, you know, to help people get out of beds and that sort of thing. This is a good program. I encourage, if you have constituents that are in need of some help in their safety area, I encourage you to have them contact John Mikowski, our government affairs person, and we can get that taken care of. We give out about 100 of these things a year, and they're very helpful for a small business to get these grants. Then the contract, the LogSafe program, the loggers rebate. This was set up a number of years ago, and the idea behind it is there's assessment done on mills, on logging mills, and that money goes back to buy down insurance payments for loggers. And they're, at one time, their workers' comp rates were the highest in the state. Now they've been bought down a lot. And what happens, they're able to take advantage of this program as long as they take safety instructions every year. And now the logging workers' comp rates are one of the lowest in the state. They're one of the lowest in the country. They've done a really good job, and I think this program has a lot to do with that, in addition to change the technology. The construction codes and licensing has a contractor recovery fund. This is paid for by an assessment on licensed contractors. When a homeowner and a contractor have a dispute, and when the homeowner is found out to be correct and the contractor is unable to pay for their problems, this pays up to $75,000 of dispute they may have had with the contractor. It's basically paid out of assessment on the contractors. We've worked this out with the contractors over the years, and it's been cheaper than being bonded for them. It's been a good deal for them to avoid being bonded. And for contract electrical inspectors, what we do there, we contract with somewhere around 70 to 80 electrical inspectors a year. And the reason we contract with them and don't have them hired on a permanent basis is that the construction economy goes up and down. As we all know, in 2008, 2009, 2010, it was way down. So we didn't have to pay these people because the number of inspections was way down. Now it's back up, so we've hired more people back on, and some people will make full-time, or others do it part-time. And most of these contract electrical inspectors are in outstate, or in Greater Minnesota. Then labor standards and apprenticeship, we have LEAP grants, $100,000. That's for, it's given to nonprofits to prepare minorities for the construction trades. So you can see the total agency external expenditure of $76 million per year, while our internal are around 50. The next page we have is in the Workers' Compensation Division. We have 121 employees. This is just an interesting point. I had the good fortune of being a commissioner of this department 20-some years ago. At that time, this division had 200 employees. And it's an indication of a couple things that tell you something about what's going on in society today. One thing is there are fewer injuries today. There's fewer people getting hurt on the job. So we've had fewer people out there. And also, technology replaced a lot of people. So we've reduced the size of that that division. Has gone down over time, over a 20-year period, from about 200 to 120. And I don't know if it's good or bad, but it's a reality. It's certainly good that we're having fewer injuries. At the same time, fewer people are working there, and we're relying more on various forms of technology. Anyway, the operating budget there is $10.7 million. What we do there is help employees injured on the job receive proper medical treatment and benefit payments in a timely manner. We also mediate disputes, and we issue penalties for late benefit payments to insured employees and review records to ensure that the laws are followed. We have a number of divisions there you can see. One of the things that workers' comp policy is a difficult issue. One time it was a very contentious issue in the legislature. And so what the legislature did in the mid-90s is set up what's called the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. And Representative Mahoney, for example, is a member of that, representing the Democratic caucus, is an ex-officio member. There are four legislative people, legislators who are ex-officio members, but there are also five representatives from labor and five representatives from business. The two permanent members are the president of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and the president of the Minnesota State LCIO. Before we do any workers' comp policy proposals, they have to go through the Workers' Comp Advisory Council. The idea there is to work out any differences there as opposed to the legislature, because these issues can be very contentious. Now, the legislature can certainly change that policy at any time it wants, how it wants to approach it, but that's the way it's been done in the past, and I realize that there are some people who sometimes criticize it, but I think it's worked pretty well over the state over the years to be sure that both business and labor agree on issues. As you can see, we get 22,000 first reports of injuries. Those are when you get hurt on the job, you file a first report of injury. Most injuries are not particularly serious, but there are a number of more serious. 507 mediations we conduct a year, and there are 2 million workers' comp files were processed in fiscal year 14, and we audited 68,000. We covered $2.6 million underpayments to injured workers. We look at a file, go through it, make sure that the injured workers receive the proper payment, and if she or he is not, we order the insurance company to pay up. The next page, the workers' compensation fund, just breaks down what happens to the money that comes with it. You see the supplementary benefits I talked about earlier. That pays about 3,000 claimants every biennium, $76 million. That's one of those benefits that will expire sometime, will run out as those people die off over the next two or three decades. Then second injury benefits is also the same thing. There are about 400 people receiving second injury benefits. That's another benefit that will go away. The third one, the benefits paid to employees of uninsured and bankrupt self-insured employers. There are somewhere around 800 to 1,000 people receiving benefits a year under that program. And the administration of workers' compensation and the state portion of OSHA programs and labor industry is $46 million for biennium, and the Office of Administrative Hearings. You can see that we support the various sums that are down there. With the next page is OSHA is divided into two things. First is compliance. That's the bigger issue. That's the one we hear about when people, OSHA inspectors, go out to workplace and inspect it, and may come out with penalties or may not. That's the larger part. It's funded half with federal government, half with out of state funds. And the state funds come out of the workers' compensation assessments. The legislature made that decision, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago when they started doing that. They do on-site inspections, issue citations for noncompliance, interpret standards, and help employees understand how to comply with the standards. We're doing about 2,500 compliance inspections the past year. We also do a lot of outreach and training presentations. We do construction breakfasts, we call. Call them, as well as a number of others. And last year we had 3,100 participants. The next part of, before we get to that, there's two programs we have that are called the partnership program. They're very important to how we operate. One is called the MnSTAR program, and that's for companies with more than 250 employees at a work site. And what they do, we go through a wall-to-wall inspection lasting a few days. And we guarantee them if they keep it as safe as they have it, we will not inspect them. You may have seen, occasionally you'll see a work site flying a MnSTAR flag. That means they're one of these companies that will not be inspected by us, and they've made a commitment to being a safe place. We think it's a great program. We also, for smaller firms, we have a MnSTAR program that does the same thing. And then we also do partnerships with construction companies that... we work with them to ensure that their general contractors and the subs are providing a safe workplace, and we promise not to inspect them as long as they work with us on general inspections. However, if there's a fatality or serious injury, we obviously take it away, or if there's very many small injuries too. And workplace safety consultation, they're the group you call up OSHA and you want someone to come out and give you some advice. They don't inspect you, they just tell you what would happen if OSHA did an inspection. And it's a great deal. It's a free thing. I wish more Minnesota companies would take advantage of it. It's just a great deal. They'll come out and they'll tell you what's right, what's wrong with your work site, and they'll make you an assurance that if there's anything wrong with it, they will not tell compliance about it unless it's a real hazard. That's even a death or serious injury. But other than that, they will tell you how to fix up your work site, and you'll be assured not have an inspection for, I think, it's 30 days or something. We also do a lot of education outreach and the consultation awards of safety grants I talked about earlier. Our next division is labor standards. There we've got 14 employees. That's the one area that's funded out of the general fund. They're the people that you get fired from your job, and you don't get paid. That's the place you call, or you're you are working and your employer's not paying you, or you're considered that you think your child's working, should not be working late hours, say a child's under 16 or something working late hours, you call us and we'll work with somebody that. So child labor laws, overtime laws, those are 48 hours in Minnesota, the federal law is 40 hours, minimum wage violation, prevailing wage, the Women's Economic Security Act and parental leave laws, and that sort of thing. Since 2011, we've recovered more than $4.5 million in back wages owed to workers. You walk up there, I go into that their offices there, and they're getting calls all the time and emails. Like it says, 24,500 phone calls, emails a day. They're a very busy group of people. They don't go out and do many inspections. We just don't have time. Instead, we rely on people reporting stuff to us, then try to call the offending party and try to work something out. We're not too interested in getting fines or penalties. We just want people to get the money they're owed. That's our whole goal there. The apprenticeship section is funded out of the Workforce Development Fund. And we have seven employees there, and you can see the budget's around $780,000. The apprenticeships go, 80% of apprenticeships in Minnesota are in the construction trades. So it goes up, the numbers goes up and down with the construction business. So when I took office in January 2011, I think we had 4,500 apprentices. Now you can see it's up to 8,400, and presumably it'll go up. It was higher, I think, in 2007 or 2006. It was around 9,500. So, 80% are in the construction trades. We'd like to see the apprenticeship, the dual training process offered by apprenticeship in a lot more other fields. We've worked with representative with others and trying to putting things together. We've got some ideas. We'll be coming out with. There are some bills that are being sponsored, and we think that dual training is a great way of approaching it. You're learning on the job, plus you're getting some education. You're going to school or taking classes, that sort of thing. It's a very good program. And what we do, we register the programs, make sure they're providing proper services, they're working right. And what happens, you finish your apprenticeship program, then you get a journey card. Representative Mahoney is a pipe fitter apprentice. He worked for, 3, 4, 5 years as an apprentice. And then
my colleague said, I worked my whole career as an apprentice.
Well, then some even question whether you're working at all.
They said that too.
Anyway, it's a good program, and you end up with a transferable card. You can show people that you got a credential, that you know what you're doing. So if you lose your job in one place or you want to move, you have a credential and you show somebody I'm skilled in a given trade or craft, and you take it to another place. We'd like to see more of it. We have it in manufacturing, we have it in printing, and healthcare, but we'd like to see it develop more and more. The next one we have is the Construction Codes and Licensing Division, which is actually the biggest division of the department, and that is 155 employees, and its budget annually is $28 million. They regulate, license, inspect, you can see boilers, building codes, contract registration, electrical, elevators, and others. This is an area, because in the construction business, it does go up and down with the construction economy. So there were people laid off under my predecessor in 2009, 2010 because of the downturn in the economy. And now we've been hiring people back because just the need is so great. And you can see we issue 128,000 personal business licenses a year, 120,000 electrical and construction permits. The permits are the ones that allow you to go ahead on a project. And we do 157,000 inspections per year. We also do building codes, and what we try to do, under the law, we can delegate building code enforcement to local municipalities. I think we've delegated to over 500 municipalities the right to enforce their own building codes. We'd much prefer they do it than we do it. But if they don't do it, if they don't want to do it, then we do it for them. And we think it's a better thing, the more we can delegate out to get down the local level of government, better off we all are, in our opinion. Then finally, we have a general support division. It just does the overhead functions that any agency or any business has to do: communications, financial services, general counsel, human resources, legislative relations, and then my favorite, the Office of Combative Sports, which regulates boxing and mixed martial arts.
And I did not know that.
Mr. Chairman, anytime you want to come to a boxing match or a mixed martial art, we'll set it up for you.
Okay. Well, we have a few questions. Representative Barrett.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a couple questions for you, if you don't mind. Going back to the budget, I guess, first of all. Looks like you're running a slight deficit. If you look at your expenses versus your revenue, you're about $5 million off. And so I'm wondering how you...
the numbers, but we're not running a deficit.
We're not running a deficit. Are these different years then, probably?
Yeah, probably different years. Maybe some rounding stuff that add up, but we're not running a deficit.
Okay. So you have $241 million in revenue and $246,900 in expenses. You look at the two pages.
What page you got? We're not right. Federal government financing.
Just rounding?
Yeah,
government rounding, I suppose,
$5 million
wrong.
I don't... Wow. We're not running a deficit, but I'm not sure whether... It's a good catch.
Thank you.
I'll find out soon I leave.
Okay.
Someone will tell me what's going on, but that's... We're not running... We don't run a deficit.
Okay. Thank you.
In fact, we are... We will be coming in for the CCLD. Will be coming in later on. You're not an appropriations committee, but we will be coming in with actually asking to lower our fees because we're bringing in too much money right now.
Oh, nice. So one other question, if you don't mind, and it might be related, may not be, but you look at the workers' compensation fund, the amount of money that you guys are taking in, which I think piggybacks on what you just said. So you're taking in $164 million in a two-year period. You go to the other page, and you're paying out in benefits $116. So there's a surplus there, but then you have to subtract your administrative workers' comp administrative. But even if you add the two together, if you take your workers' compensation fund of $164, you subtract your benefits of $116 and your administration of $21, you still have a surplus. I guess what I would describe as a surplus. So I'm just wondering what happens to that. Overpayment that employers are paying that should be going out in benefits. Where is that money?
There is the assessments have been dropping. I have figures here somewhere. Assessments have been dropping. Like 2004, the assessment rate is 27.4. Last year's 19, or this year's 19.9. It's been going down. We've tried to keep a little bit of a surplus for 3 to 5 months in case just extra money going on. I'm not sure. I'll go through this again when I'm not sure. So there's a surplus just in the event things go bad. But we're trying to keep it as tight as possible.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's very important. We don't need any money. We don't need extra money, but I do want to make sure we have enough money in case we get hit by a big, a major self-insurer goes out of business.
Uh-huh.
We have to pay benefits to somebody. Several meatpacking plants went under in the 1990s. We're still paying out big ones on them. And another steel company went out early 2000. They're paying benefits. So we're always concerned the self-insurer goes out of business. We have to pick up a bunch of payments right away so we can cover those. But I'll check on the numbers. I don't think it should be that good. I'm glad you caught it, but I'll check and make sure.
Representative Barrett? Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. So given the fact that it looks like you're running a deficit, you're really not because you said you're not, but all the money's accounted for some way. So do you have a special savings account in which this surplus workers' comp payments are in, and actually in the bank somewhere?
The state administers it. We turned it over to the Department of Management and Budget, and they deposit somewhere. I'm not sure where.
Okay.
We give the money to them, and they get them. We get the money out. You know, it's an exchange.
Thank you,
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for the answer to those questions. Because Representative Barrett asked a lot of the questions. Just one small question to kind of wrap that up on the workman's compensation fund. This money that's going into another account, the surplus. Do you know what the balance of that is at this time?
Find out pretty easily, but I don't know the balance.
Okay, that'd be great. Thank you. That was my only question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
In traveling throughout my district, we look at the last page regulations, licensing, inspections. Those seem to be concerns to the small businesses in my area. And I'm not questioning some of the statistics here. I like comparisons. I'm wondering how the cost and the applications apply to some of our neighboring states, Wisconsin, North Dakota, Iowa, perhaps. You know, we're trying to build a workforce that's competitive, but also we're trying to build a business climate that's competitive. And I'm not saying that necessarily you should have those statistics, but it's something that I think as a committee, it would be very helpful to see how we compare in these areas. And maybe that's more of a comment than a question, but would you have access to those figures as well?
Representative, Mr. Chairman, I think so. I don't have the figures, but I would think we could find them. I would think it would be pretty easy. You know, we'll see if we can get them. If not, we'll get back to you and explain why we can't. But we'll get them in and get to the whole committee if that's satisfactory.
That would be great. Thank you.
We'll look at the neighboring states, and if there are any national averages, I'm not sure they would apply, but we'll look at the neighboring states anyway. Does that make sense? Look at those? Or?
That would be fine. I appreciate it much, and that would be all, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've got a number of questions here, but I will say one thing. If you go to the second to the last page of the construction code and licensing regulations and inspections, the top there, the boilers, when I came many years, it seems like a lifetime ago, a three-pound boiler will, you know, take a building down. It blows up. And I think it was somewhere over 27,000 boilers at that time had not been inspected in 20 years, either the insurance companies or the state, because it basically the paperwork got lost. And so that's what we can do here is we find some of these things. Now, I'll give credit to the commissioner and the past commissioners, whether it's Swigum or I'm trying to think of the other one before him. They came to us and asked for a $5 addition to the license, and they got all those boilers either tracked down off their records or their insurance back onto them, I think within 3 years. And that's an awful lot of inspections to do. So some of the things that we do on this committee don't look like they're important, but a good number of years ago, a pipe fitter kid had a tank go up in front of the Capitol, and his widow got less than the $35,000 that they get now from workers' comp. But that's just a kind of an explanation of what we kind of sometimes do around here and what we find. But Commissioner, I'm going to go on a couple of things here. On your work comp, as it pertains to workers' comp, do you audit and share that audit with the legislature? Do you audit the insurance companies and the payments?
Representative Mahoney, Mr. Chairman, what we audit, we don't audit the insurance companies. That's the responsibility of the Department of Commerce. We don't regulate the insurance companies other than we regulate their relationships with individual work comp beneficiaries. So we audit the files of individual work comp recipients to make sure that individuals are getting paid what they're owed. We don't look at the actual, we don't look at the companies. That's the Department of Commerce.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
I know you did a study on them that you have at your office, and one of the things that I want to share with the committee was the administrative costs of these insurance companies. Now, did you notice the commissioner took a gulp? Some of the administrative costs for these insurers is 88% of the premium dollar. So every 88 cents of the dollar goes to administration, and 12 cents goes to workers. And some of them, they're good companies, that are down to 12% administrative. I think was it 12 or was it 20% administrative costs? I can't remember off the top of my head.
I can't either, but it was
yeah. But some of those companies are really good. So if you have people in your districts that are complaining about workers' comp, ask them to talk to their insurance company about what's their administrative costs. That's a huge difference. But if you've got that, if it's online, you should listserv that to our members so that they can take a look at it. Because if we're going to do, I won't bring up DRGs, I promise you.
Thank you.
Our members should start to see that, because that's a big expense for businesses, workers' comp insurance. And I may be a Democrat, but I do understand that when you're paying those kind of dollars for your employees to keep them safe. And my other question is on apprenticeship. I know that there's a bills floating around here for workforce training. Could you explain, or do you have someone here that could explain the requirements for an apprenticeship before everyone starts calling all these things apprenticeships? And the requirement that an employer has if and when they decide to enter into an apprenticeship program?
I'll briefly try to describe it. It won't be as detailed as I'd like to be. But what an apprenticeship program is, it's a federal, we're designated as the agency to interpret the federal apprenticeship guidelines. Federal apprenticeship laws, the Fitzgerald Act of 1937. And what an employer sponsor agrees, or it can be a union too, or a trade association does some too, what they agree to provide so much that an individual goes through, so much on-the-job training, so much safety training, and so many hours of safe training, and so many hours in the classroom training over a number of years. Sometimes with electricians, it's 7,500 hours, it's the highest, and with others, it's much less, it's around 2,000 hours. However, the important thing is that we insist that it all be done, and the safety stuff be there, and that everything else be there, be a registered program, and that an individual, that they don't use it just to put someone on to avoid paying high wages. Or to pay low wages. They don't put someone on just to work there for 3 months and then let them go. But we like them to see them be rework. 50% of those enrolled in apprenticeship programs do finish. Now, some of those people just, they find other things they want to do. They may work for a summer on construction, decide they don't want to do that. Or they work at a manufacturing site and they decide they want to do something else with their time. But 50% do complete them, and we think that it's a great program. It's one that it's worth a lot. You get a credential at the end. That's an important thing, that you're able to leave your employer and go to another employer and say, "I'm a credentialed employee. I'm a credentialed pipe fitter, and I can do this work. And I've done it here. I've done it there, but I can do the work. And it's backed by the state of Minnesota, their credentialing system."
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you. One more question, Mr. Commissioner. In our current apprenticeship program, the state's share of any and all apprenticeship cost is what you have here. Typically the apprenticeship programs that are out there are paid for by whom?
Paid for by the employer. By the sometimes by, in some cases by the union, some cases by the sponsor of the program, and the sponsors can be a union, can be an employer, can be a trade association, be a variety of sponsors, but they're paying the expenses. Or the individual apprentice may end up paying for a certain amount of schooling too. That's going to vary. I think Representative Norton has spent a lot of time looking at this issue, and that's going to vary from program to program. But the state is not paying for, and the typical apprenticeship.